This episode is brought to you by the UNC School of the Arts' critically acclaimed School of Drama. Ranked number 3 in the world by The Hollywood Reporter, UNCSA is where talent meets opportunity. Alumni, which includes the likes of Anthony Mackie, Anna Camp, and Billy Magnuson, have made their mark on the industry, proving that with the right preparation, the stage and screen are yours to conquer. UNCSA prepares you for a successful career, nurturing your craft and turning aspirations into reality. Ready to stand in the spotlight? Discover how at uncsa.edu/backstage.
If you have a spirit of playfulness, that's going to come across in the liveliness of the scene, whether it's a playful, funny scene or not. It's just like actually something is sort of alive there. And with all that, you know, blue screen, green screen, gray suits, whatever it is, you know, there's an element to which it is ridiculous. But there's also an element where all it's calling for is just more imagination.
Welcome to a new episode of In the Envelope, the Actors Podcast. I am your host, backstage senior editor, Vinny Mancuso, and joining us today is a true gentleman, a wonderful actor, the great Dan Stevens. Now, there's a few places you might have first met Dan. Maybe it was his 3 seasons and then very contested exit from Downton Abbey, or maybe it was leading Noah Hawley's mind trip of a Marvel series, Legion, for 2 years, or possibly it was his frightening and funny turn in Adam Wingard's incredible thriller, The Guest. No matter where you first saw Dan, you'll probably be seeing him again very soon in the near future. He's got 3 big projects coming back to back to back in 2024, starting with Godzilla and Kong, The New Empire, which reunites Dan with Adam Wingard, his guest director, for a role alongside his old college pal, Rebecca Hall, as well as, of course, his new friends, Godzilla and King Kong. He's also got Cuckoo, Neon's horror film with Euphoria star Hunter Schafer. And soon after that comes Abigail, the creature feature directed by Radio Silence, directors best known for bringing the Scream franchise back to life. Dan was so great here, discussing not only what it's like to be an actor juggling such a wide variety of projects all at once, but also the long road that it took to get here. Along the way, we touch on Shakespeare, on working with people like Ben Stiller and Harrison Ford, on persistent James Bond rumors. It's a wonderful, as you can tell, wide-ranging chat. Let's get right into it. Here is Dan Stevens. Dan, how's it going?
It's going good. Nice to talk to you.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to meet you. Where in the world are you right now?
I am, as of a couple of days ago, back in LA for a minute. Very nice. But I've been hearing about the country on various missions over the last couple of weeks. Yeah.
Absolutely. Is it one of those things where it's kind of hard to find time and space? You're like, what time zone am I in? Where in the world am I?
Very much the time zone thing is, yeah. But I'm starting to think that jet lag is just a state of mind. I don't know. or maybe it's a permanent state of mind. I'm not sure.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, I'm so excited to talk to you today. There's a lot to talk about. This is a big time for you. I think you have 3 movies coming out within months of each other.
Yeah, it's one of those funny things where you squirrel away making things over the course of 2 or 3 years, and then they all come out in the space of a few weeks. But it's great. It's busy is good, and it's always nice to finally get the work out there. It's just sometimes I have to remind myself which thing I'm talking about at the beginning of each interview, but that's all right.
Well, we're gonna talk about everything and everything.
That we talk about all of them. Then I don't need to worry.
But I do want to say a quick congratulations. We're a couple weeks out from the Oscars, and you had a small role in The Boy and the Heron, if I'm not mistaken.
I did.
A very small role. I did not know that until I was going to do this interview.
That's all right. There's a few of us sort of, you know, in there in sort of lesser capacities. Basically, I think for this one, because it was such a special movie for them, for the studio, they invited back a lot of people who'd done voices on other Ghibli projects, and I'd done a voice for them in the past. And so listen, any size role in a Miyazaki movie is a huge honor, and I love that film, and I'm delighted it's done so well.
So as I mentioned, you have a couple of movies coming out, but I do also, because we are, you know, backstage, we're an actors podcast, we like going all the way to the back. And I was just thinking about what you have recently. And one of those movies is Godzilla and Kong, which you are co-starring in with Rebecca Hall, who you go very far back.
Way back. Yes.
All the way back to Macbeth.
Indeed.
The Marlowe Society production.
Yeah, you've done your research. Yeah, that's how we met. It was my first term, first semester at Cambridge, and we were both cast as Mr. and Mrs. M, and then we've done theater together since. We've done other movies together, and you know, we lived together briefly after we went on theater tour together, and we go a long way back, and it's just delightful, silly, ridiculous that, you know, these old friends sort of get to end up in a big movie like this together, you know, filming in Australia and now, you know, on the press tour. It's just, it makes the whole thing, you know, a lot of fun and really gives it some sort of warmth and bit of soul to it. It's good fun.
Where were you in your sort of acting journey during that production of Macbeth? Who were you as an actor when you were in Macbeth production?
Don't know. I mean, honestly, at that time, I was more focused on doing stand-up. I was like part of the Footlights, and like my main preoccupation every week was, you know, writing another 5 minutes of stand-up, doing some weird character monologues, you know, sketch shows, things like that. I had done theater at school, at high school, and you know, I knew that I wanted to be an actor, and I knew that I didn't necessarily want to go to drama school because I was scared it was going to like institutionalize it and kill my love of it for some reason. I can't quite explain that, but that's sort of part of my reasoning. But I did know that, you know, going to Cambridge, I still had a big academic interest. I knew that Cambridge was a path into the industry. A lot of great actors had gone that way, and comedians too. And so that was really where my focus is. I thought I'll throw my hat into the ring and audition for this production of Macbeth, which was open to the whole university. And you know, I thought, like, in my first year, but I might as well try. And was really surprised when I landed the role, as were a few other people. I think were kind of a bit more like on the scene there and like expecting to book a role. Anyway, it was so lucky to be thrown together with Rebecca, really, because, you know, we immediately became friends, and it's been a huge part of my life. You know, my friendship with her, and, you know, both in our careers, but also just as friends. You know, she's been there for me. And I hope vice versa, over the last 20 years in all sorts of ways.
Amazing. So that's an interesting way into, you know, becoming an actor in the first place. You mentioned you were very interested in stand-up. You kind of, you know, didn't want to dilute the pull towards. So what was the sort of pull towards acting? You know, what was the very beginnings of you wanting to maybe pursue this in a more serious way?
Yeah, I think it was the serious way. I don't think I realized until quite later on. I knew that it was a thing, and I knew it was a thing I was impelled to do. So at school, I was always kind of either acting up in the class or channeled there by a wise teacher. Mm-hmm. You know, who was like, okay, I think you need to be doing this. And so I was always drawn to doing it. But I think, you know, I didn't realize it was a real job, I don't think, until a bit later on, and probably just before heading to Cambridge, and then, you know, thinking, well, actually, this is something I want to pursue. But the stand-up was very important to me because there was something about it, about like making your own words work on stage and learning about crowd work and just sort of, you know, listening to laughs and all of the sort of craft of stand-up. And I still love watching stand-up. And I, you know, there's a bit of me that thinks, you know, it's probably too late and not the best idea, but like, I love it as an art form, and I really sort of, I think it's one of the last places that people can really kind of speak their mind a bit.
I'd be curious for you to return to it. I don't know. I feel like that's.
I'd never say never. I don't know. It's every time I see it, I'm like, oh guys, it's so good. You know, when it's good, it's really, really good. And I sort of admire it in all its forms. I even admire people who bomb. You know, I sort of like, I get this strange kind of like empathy for them, and I just kind of like admire the endeavor, and I've seen great people bomb, and I've seen, you know, whatever. I just sort of like, I like it as a format, you know. But yeah, I think doing that sort of informed a lot of how I work in theater. Like, you know, when other people have written the words and they're guaranteed to be good, it's not just me writing sort of stupid thoughts the night before. it gave me a very interesting training about, you know, how to make those words work and how to work with an audience and that kind of thing. And I think nothing is as terrifying as setting out and doing stand up, you know. So yeah, doing any kind of play will never be as scary as that. And I felt like I wanted to sort of get that out of my system, really.
That's really interesting. I do find stand up as an art form fascinating, because like you said, it's just you on a stage and people are coming there and you are daring to say, I'm going to make you laugh now, which is, you know, not very a good setup to make somebody laugh. And it's just, it's terrifying.
The good ones are not just there to make you laugh, I think. Like the ones I've always sort of admired have a real, I want to say agenda, but I don't mean that in a sort of political way. But there's like, they're there because they're angry about something, or they've been really fucking thinking about something. Mm-hmm. They don't just want to sort of be too serious about it. I think the best way to sort of push some of those thoughts sometimes is through humor. And I just applaud that, the existence of the stand-up as like a person who can potentially, you know, be truth to evil or whatever, and just sort of, you know, literally stand up to things in certain times. And yeah, I just really sort of value it. And I find every, you know, I watch a lot of specials and I really love it.
Well, if you get a spare moment, let's make it a reality here. I would just, because, you know, seeing you on screen and seeing you on stage, I think it's not a lot of people know that about you in your background. I think that'd be really interesting.
Yeah, it's always somewhere in the back of my mind and I'm like, no, I can't. Can I? Maybe? Don't know.
We'll see. Well, if the journey starts here. So I am curious, you know, when you mentioned when you did start realizing, oh, this is something I kind of want to pursue. What was the sort of education of that? You know, like when did you start like actively adding things to your toolbox? You know, when did you start saying, oh, this actually works. I can do this. This is something I can logistically do.
I suppose thinking about that, you know, an early memory and an earlier sort of impetus about, you know, to go into the industry was, I actually got cast to play Macbeth when I was at high school as well.
There you go.
When I was about 14. So I'd already done the role once. and when I got that part, my dad, he could see that I, you know, had this sort of interest in it. And he took me up to see the Royal Shakespeare Company, Stratford-upon-Avon in England. Mm-hmm. And we just saw, we stayed for a few days, and it's, you know, it's a rep company. And so we saw basically everything that they had on that week. And I think the most exciting thing, and it still remains the most exciting thing to me, I think, about what I do, what we do, mm-hmm. is to see, first of all, see a brilliant production of whatever it was, whether it was Hamlet or Merry Wives of Windsor, or I can't remember. There was a whole bunch of things we saw. To see that brilliant production, but then to see some of those same actors popping up in another production in a totally different role, mm-hmm. less than 48 hours later. Like that to me, especially in theatre, was magic. That you were allowed to do that, that these people could kind of create these characters and just, you know, play them simultaneously. And I think that kind of versatility is something that was always in the back of my mind. So I think, you know, once things got going for me, because, you know, there's two kinds of, well, I don't want to narrow it down to two, but there's different kinds of career.
In general.
There's like, there's also, you know, there's certain actors where, you know, very, very early on, very clearly a casting director is like, oh, you're this kind of actor, you're going to play these kind of roles. And they get that kind of work and they stay in that kind of work and they're brilliant at it. And that is like what they do. And we recognize them for that. And they show up and it's like, oh, they're going to be that person. Great. Then there's others where like, you don't even know that it's them. Mm-hmm. In a thing, you're like, wait, is that so-and-so? You know, and you know, the idea of being in two movies at the same time. Like, I always remember hearing a story about a movie producer who went to see Daniel Day-Lewis in My Beautiful Laundrette. Mm-hmm. And he came out of the movie theater and he had, you know, the day off or whatever. I guess he wasn't busy. So he went and saw another movie and he went down the street, popped into the Odeon there and saw Room with a View.
Yeah.
And had no idea that he was like watching the same actor and was just completely blown away. And like that kind of thing just like really excites me, where it's just like, yeah, you know, you don't have to be the same each time. And pushing the envelope and finding new characters, finding new ways of expressing yourself, you know, really kind of chameleonic career. That has always really excited me. And so I think once I was sort of allowed to step outside of perhaps the sort of expected panel, mm-hmm. then I was like, oh, hang on, I think we might have something going here. Like this is kind of what I wanted, even though I couldn't necessarily put my finger on that at the time. It was just like, oh, it's actually just the ability to sort of flex those muscles and try something completely different that almost feels like not allowed in a way, like you're sort of escaping the channel. is kind of exciting to me as well. It's just like, and I always applaud any performer, whether it's like a comedian trying to do a serious role or vice versa or something, you know, people just like trying something that is actively outside of their comfort zone is like, for me, one of the most exciting things to watch.
Yeah. So you it's fair to say that, you know, a time like this where you have something like Godzilla and Kong and then followed up by something smaller like, you know, Cuckoo, that's kind of like, was the goal.
Yeah.
You know, it was the goal of like...
It's not quite My Beautiful Laundra and Room with a View, but I'll take it.
in spirit, absolutely.
It's the same idea. But yeah, exactly. You know, and getting to just show different characters that have sort of occurred to me, really. And Cuckoo is very much a sort of character lead, you know, and I would say Trapper in Kong is as well. It's like, it's not sort of a straight role. He's kind of a, you know, cheeky, optimistic chappy. He's got, you know, a bit of fun in there. And I love just sort of rolling those characters into things like this.
Absolutely. So when we sort of think about that earliest learning stage of your career, you're discussing the things that you wanted to do and the things, you know, the goals you had. How did you go about sort of the nitty gritty of it? You know, like your process, I guess. I know that acting, you know, asking actors about their acting process is, you know, it can be a little bit like, I don't want to say I have a process, but how did you go about taking things in and being like, oh, I can use this. This is something I can do.
Yeah. I think that's definitely developed over time. And as I say, because of my sort of stubborn refusal to go and train properly, I've had to train on the job and have just kind of like made it my business to learn from everybody that I come into contact with, good or bad, you know, or remember not to do whatever they're doing, or wow, that's incredible, I must really try and, you know. I'd say it's almost harder to learn from good people, because it's like when somebody's great, you're just kind of watching them and you're just like, fucking hell, that's brilliant. I don't know how they do that, you know. Whereas, I like watching the sort of good and bad. And I think initially I was probably trying, and I think this is true of a lot of actors, trying to sort of mold myself into what I thought somebody else wanted the role to be. Mm-hmm. Like whether it was the director or whether I, you know, just to sort of, it was like, okay, I'll just sort of bend and be this person, which was sort of moderately successful, but not really. I was sort of doing a pale imitation of something that I thought, you know. And then increasingly, whatever the character is, it's either drawing on people that I've sort of known either personally or just sort of absorbed over the years, types of characters that I've been around in different sort of contexts, but also just like finding that part of myself that relates to that character, however awful that person might be, mm-hmm. or lovely. But, you know, just sort of finding a piece of myself, like putting, you know, rather than sort of trying to be what somebody else wants that role to be, just so like, well, what would I do with it? And, mm-hmm. and, you know, what part of me would I use for this? Who do I have in my sort of memory bank that I would use for this? And who would I like to see this person be? And that was very true of something like Trapper, where it's like, there's 100 different ways you could play mm-hmm. that part. But I've always kind of liked that type of character in a mission like that, in a sort of adventure comedy mm-hmm. like that, you know, somebody who's just like relentlessly optimistic in the
Hawaiian
face
shirt. Oh, it's the Hawaiian shirt.
Yeah, yeah. Just sort of like a robust sense of wonder, which I think is, you know, a really nice quality to have in a sort of apocalyptic setting. So, you know, things like that. And so I think it's evolved over time, in answer to your question, where it's something, you know, to make it less of a reach out there and more just a kind of look in here, and sort of put that out there in some form, which is not to say that I am all of the people that I play, mm-hmm. but there's just sort of little character traits where I'm just like, oh yeah, I think I recognize that impulse in this person. And then you put it in a very absurd setting, like it's a, you know, you accidentally kidnapped a vampire ballerina, or you're facing down a 300-foot titan, you know.
Very, very.
Oh, very. Oh, good, good, good. Yeah, it's absolutely bonkers.
that's what we need to hear. I love that. You mentioned the sort of finding that on the job. You know, finding that sort of thing that worked for you. Is there a role in your career that marked a switch in your head, or like, you know, is there any time or period, project, anything like that where you're like, oh, this, I did it this way and it worked better than it has in the past? Or is that really just stretched out over time?
I don't know if there would be like one specific one, because I think, you know, that's a myth that there's like the role that just like turns it all on and everything's great.
Yeah.
I did find that the way that I went about preparing for something like The Guest and the kind of role that it was, where it was just like nothing I'd ever been offered before, but definitely something, the kind of movie that I'd loved, that kind of, you know, 80s B action movie kind of vibe, is just like fun. And, you know, English boys don't get to play those very often. So I went about it in a very, very physical preparation. I think that was something that has also kind of worked its way in over the years. It's like physically preparing for a role. And I don't just mean like getting jacked, but actually like the act of like working out, of doing certain kinds of training, like, you know, familiarizing myself with taking apart a weapon. It's like learning skills that a character would know that I don't necessarily possess and making them my own. Just like, even just like the act of flicking a butterfly knife, which was not something I spent my adolescence doing personally, but I just got it down and I was just like, okay, that, you know, that's like in the bones of this character now. Dancing has come into a lot of roles, whether they are a dancer or not. It's like, how would this person dance? Does this person dance? Mm-hmm. And, you know, if there is dance involved, like how that informs the physicality of the role that then, you know, has a huge effect on character that comes out, you know, how that person holds themselves, how they move, which again, coming from a sort of classical British theatre background, a lot of the tradition there is sort of acting from the neck up, and it's very cerebral and it's brilliant and it sounds gorgeous, you know, beautiful voices, incredible diction, you know, make poetry sing. That's great. And I, you know, having worked with people steeped in that tradition, it's like, that is a wonderful thing to have been around and to have learned from. But increasingly sort of taking that and moving that more into my body has been a huge sort of step. And that's something that I definitely learned from getting more into movies over here and that, and the way that people prepare over here.
It's interesting. I don't remember who we had on the show, but there's somebody who was, you know, involved with the Marvel movies and, you know, somebody who had to physically transform for a role. And something said that I found really interesting is like stuck with me is like, you kind of have to figure out why the character is in such good shape. It's not just, you know, getting in shape.
Yes.
It's like, well, maybe it's insecurity. Maybe it's something else. Why are they in such good shape? And that's the question you kind of have to answer. And that really just sort of stuck in my head.
I mean, I think the answer for those movies is because they're in a Marvel movie. But generally speaking, like, not all characters are ripped. You know, they don't need to be. It's often the vanity of the actor or the director, even, where it's like, you should really, you know, try and... But it's not necessary for all roles. And actually, it's kind of nice to not feel the pressure to do that every time. Because otherwise, if you're just preparing in that way for every role, it's going to lead to a certain kind of preparation and a certain kind of sort of narrow band of character, I would say. That's also my excuse for not going to the gym all the time.
Whatever works. This sort of piggyback of what you were just saying, you know, you had a lot of theater experience, a lot of training, and then you sort of learned on the job. So do you remember how you first learned to put all this together specifically for the camera? Do you remember the first time you were on camera and how you made all this training and stuff work for the lens and not just for the stage?
I don't remember it all coming together the first time I did it. In fact, the first few years, I think I was doing it. You know, I think, you know, I haven't looked back on a lot of my sort of early stuff, but I'm sure that a lot of it, and you see it in other actors as well, and young actors, especially who've only done theater, it's like, there is that sort of acting from the neck up thing, and you speak all the lines very beautifully and make sure that every word is heard, and you know, you don't dare fuss with the words on the page because you've been taught to respect every syllable of Shakespeare. And actually, increasingly, it's about sort of massaging those lines, especially on screen, you know, where generally people are less precious about the text. It depends who you're working with, but you know, there are a few writers who are like, actually, I'd like you to observe every syllable and not throw in anything. But a lot of the times people want you to put those words in your mouth and how that would sound and give that a certain kind of rhythm. And, you know, increase working with more and more comedians over the years, really, and learning about how they use improv and, you know, the idea of alt lines, not as a way of disrespecting the text, but actually as a way of like livening up what is there. So that even if you don't use the alt, the way that you've shaken up the scene and the way that you've maybe thrown a bit of a surprise into the scene there just kind of brings the whole thing alive and brings what was on the page already. So I would say, you know, different jobs have sort of unlocked that for me, like working on Night at the Museum, you know, with all those brilliant comedians, and Stiller particularly, you know, just watching how he used improvisation, working with Will Ferrell on Eurovision, you know, the way he uses improvisation to just like bring a scene alive. and occasionally find an absolute diamond, you know, more than occasionally, but, you know, it was just really, really enriching to kind of see that and be like, oh, yeah, I must try that. And then, you know, to take that onto other projects. Somebody who I would say has the best camera awareness, the awareness of the lens and what scene, what frame they are in, not even what scene they're in, but like, is Harrison Ford. On I worked with him on Call of the Wild, and
absolutely,
you know, just a kind of real, it seems to come very naturally to him, you know, just a sort of a total awareness of lens size and, you know, how to make it work, and just a real sort of you know, simplicity to some of the things he was doing that were just so effective, and that was incredibly inspiring. So yeah, it's been different people over the years, you know, and just sort of little, you know, ways of being more than like specific tricks in a toolbox. It's just like, oh yeah, I could try that, and that doesn't have to completely throw an entire production, you know.
Yeah.
I think people get scared. They're like, I'm going to try some improv. And they're like, please don't.
It's a lot of money.
it means different things to different people. But yeah, just sort of learning how to shake a script up so that it comes alive a bit more has been a fun thing to learn.
That's so interesting to hear. I always, you know, whenever people are like, what makes a movie star, you know, the definition movie star. And I feel like a lot of it does come down to like just having this innate sense of your angles and like how you translate to camera,
totally.
What shadows look like on your face. It's very interesting.
Yeah. Some people are not into that, and some people don't want to think about that. And I respect that too. And there's certainly some roles where I've tried not to think about that and just to try and sort of be in and unaware. But there are other times where, you know, and I would say, you know, Godzilla and Kong is a good example of this, where it's just like, there's a certain shot here that we need that is, I mean, there's no other way to put it. It's just like a shot that appears in a blockbuster movie occasionally. Yeah. Like you see it in Indiana Jones, and you see it, you know, it's a character comes through some leaves and looks up in awe at something incredible off in the distance. It's like, you don't need to prepare for hours for this. Yeah, you just need to kind of know like the pace, and you need to be in, you know, simpatico with the director about like what it is that we're getting here. And I sometimes love those kind of technical shots where it's just like, all it's about here is walking from here to here and just making it look cool or something. And it's like, I mean, it's harder than it sounds, but the simplicity of that sometimes as an exercise is kind of fun. And I love working with camera teams and directors, you know, when you're all working on the shot rather than it all just being about the actor making this preparation sort of come out of them. It's actually about like collectively making something look cool on screen.
Actually, I would love to discuss that in particular, because that is something I find very interesting about blockbuster filmmaking in general, is just when you watch a movie, if it's well paced, well edited, you don't notice that stuff. But in filming it, it is often setup is you come through the door. Setup is you look up. So I'm curious. You mentioned it's not as easy as it sounds. So I'm curious.
Well, it is and it isn't. You know, it's of course, if I start to sort of describe it, it's like, yeah, that's obvious and that, you know. But like, you sometimes see I see performances sometimes on screen where I'm like, oh, you didn't need to leave as fast as that, you know, like, and I'm not saying like hang around forever and you know, milk the camera, although I've been guilty, you know. I will definitely hold my hand up and say that. But when you're on camera and the, you know, every second of that is captured. So I think, again, it's like a slightly theatrical trait where it's just like, I will say my lines and then I'll get off. And it's like, and actually, you can do anything in that frame, you know, when it's on you. And if it's good, it'll stay in the picture. If it's not, they won't use it. But, you know, at least offer it up to them. And I, you know, it's something I noticed working with Stiller, was that he will, like, even with his sort of reaction stuff, he'll offer a whole bunch of things to the director while it's rolling. And sometimes you're like, wait, but that, what's happening here? And he's just like, he's just trying different things and very simple reactions that, yeah. And it's sort of, and again, it's like knowing, working with the director, knowing that you're just like giving them stuff. I like to feel that, and I like them to feel that I'm not like, you know, I'm not throwing in weird lines to mess up their movie. I'm throwing in stuff because they might use it, they might not. It got a reaction from somebody that, you know, is maybe usable or something, you know. And we're all in it to kind of make this thing together and to sort of throw things into the editor's toolbox that they can, you know, they can put together. But yeah, it's sometimes it's the simplicity of those big, and, you know, especially on a big blockbuster movie, you can spend half a day on some of those incredibly simple shots that we just have the luxury of time to be able to cover. And it is going to be part of this epic montage with a huge orchestral score underneath it. And, you know, you, it's literally about just like climbing up a ridge and looking out or something, you know, and yet that's the kind of, that's the stuff. Those are the moments that you watch a blockbuster and you think, yeah, that's really, that's cool. You know, that's what these films are all about.
You mentioned, you know, some of it is about that relationship with the director. And you've also mentioned the guest. This is a reunion with your guest director. I'm curious, you know, similar to speaking with Rebecca Hall about Look at Us Now, what is that like? You know, there's been some time between the guests, and there's obviously been a size jump in the movie. So how does that relationship creatively sort of stay the same, you know, when you're working on such a bigger scale?
Yeah, I mean, I was delighted to find that it doesn't change that much. I mean, maybe for some people it does, but, you know, Adam and I, it's not like I haven't seen him for 10 years. Like, we've stayed friends.
Yeah.
We hang out. We've been talking about all sorts of other things that we'd love to do together. And it's hard to get movies made. It's hard to get them off the ground. And so, you know, various sort of plates that we've got spinning. But obviously he had this big plate already up and running, you know, from the last movie. And so, you know, he invited me to sort of come and join the party. And what was great was not only is he brought along Simon Barrett, who co-wrote The Guest with him. He's one of our writers on this. And he brought along our art director, Tom Hammack, who designed the Guest, who told me that the art budget for the scene that introduces my character to Godzilla and Kong was bigger than the entire art budget of The Guest.
And I love so, that.
You know, it's the spirit of indie filmmaking is kind of preserved just mm-hmm. on a bigger scale with bigger toys. And we had, I would say, the same amount of fun, the same kind of fun on this as we did on that. It's just, we're in Australia and you know, in the middle of a jungle somewhere, you know, we weren't in New Mexico, but, you know, it's the same, you know, Adam still makes movies with the same sense of fun, you know, and that's what's cool about someone like Adam directing one of these sort of big blockbusters is that he's a fan. He knows what he would want to see in one of these movies, because he grew up just absolutely steeped in them. And the way that he kind of communicates that enthusiasm to everyone, all his heads of department and the actors, you know, that what we're making should be fun. So often actors take what they do a bit too seriously, I think. And like, we should all take the work seriously. And, you know, we're very, very grateful to be working. But, you know, at the end of the day, we're making something that's going to be, it should be enjoyed by moviegoers, you know, and especially if you're expecting people to fork out, you know, $20+. You want them to have a good time and not, you know, feel like that's been a waste. You know, like, the worst thing is, like, well, that's 2 hours of my life I'll never get back. It's like, no, we want to, like, you know, enrich at least 2 hours of your life, you know, with some crazy shit. And Adam's really up for that, you know, and I love that. And he was the same on The Guest. It was like, it was a funny idea, and this should be fun, you know, that this is not a serious movie. And I think a lot of people read The Guest script and thought, oh, this is horrible. Like, this is so dark. And it's like, I just thought it was hilarious. But I just thought the whole, I don't know, there was something about the tone of it I just thought was really, really funny. And I think, yeah, Adam likes to work with humor, and so do I. And so that sort of, we managed to preserve that. We had a good, fun time making this one as well, which was, you know, a delight to me.
I love that. I am curious, you know, as an actor, you know, you sort of mentioned not taking yourself too seriously. I think that's a vital part of a lot of people's, you know, approach to this. Does it sometimes feel like outside reactions to your performance are based a lot in like how unpleasant it felt? You know, do you think an actor's performance is often based in like the credit goes to how hard it was to do this performance?
Yes, I do know what you mean. And I know, yeah, there are certain roles certainly that it seems like that's the way to sort of, I don't know, is that going to make people want to go and see it? I don't know. But the idea of sort of a project being a difficult birth somehow makes it more worthy. And it's like, I don't know if that's true. Like, sure, it's you know, listen, there were some trials and tribulations on all of these things. But like, ultimately, I love getting to do what I do. I hope I have a great time doing it. It's not always the case. But, you know, it's very, very hard making a movie, period. You know, whether you're doing extreme things or not, it's just like the whole endeavor is pretty tough for everybody. So in my mind, it's better if we can all kind of have some fun while we're doing it, and that it's an enjoyable experience for the cast and the crew. Yeah, I don't know. I think I definitely know some actors who've sort of tortured themselves to get a particular result. And I just don't know if it's worth it very often. I don't know really. It's hard to quantify like how, you know, the proportion of like shit that you put yourself through to like result on screen.
Yeah.
Or, you know, I mean, I've seen like this one clip that I saw on YouTube the other day, and it was like, I think it's Billy Bob Thornton and he's in Monsters Ball. It's with Halle Berry, I think, and they're in a car and they're literally like about to roll. And he's just like, I don't know, he's just telling some absolutely filthy joke.
Mm-hmm.
And they call action and they both just like snap into the scene.
Yeah.
And it's like an incredibly serious, like moving scene. You're like, yeah, that's it, you know. And it was a bit like that working with Betty Gilpin on something like Gaslit, where it's like, you know, mm-hmm. Betty Gilpin is honestly one of the finest actresses of my generation, I think.
Absolutely.
You know, just like consistently just delivers amazingly on screen and is an absolute hoot off screen. Just like so fun and funny right up until rolling, you know, and then we're just like in it, you know. And I think, again, that's what I mean about the sort of the ability to switch in and out of roles, but also the ability to switch in and out of a role while you're making it, you know, that you don't have to bring everybody down with your shit that's going on. Like, sure, your character may be going through the, but like, try and keep that to yourself. Like, as soon as your method, whatever you want to call it, what you need to do impacts heavily on other people's ability to do their job, it's not worth it. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just not. Like, it might make your performance tiny bit better, but, you know, sure, people should respect that if you're going through an emotional scene, that, you know, we should not be, you know, telling dick and fart jokes necessarily while you're prepping for that. But like, you should have the ability to be able to switch into that. You shouldn't need, you know, months of build up to sort of preserve this strange egg of performance that you're about to just sort of plop onto the set, that, you know, we should be able to just like bring that, I think.
Absolutely. To sort of continue on that track, you're no stranger, you know, with Godzilla and Kong and stuff like Beauty and the Beast, these big productions where there's just a lot of stuff. You know, there's the green screen, or there's the beast outfit for Beauty and the Beast. Yeah. There's just a lot of outside stimuli while you're acting. Do you have any ways that you can sort of push that to the side, you know, while you're focusing on the scene? You know, you mentioned telling a joke right before they call action and you switch. How do you find it easy or helpful to do that when there's so much happening around your performance?
I mean, I think part of that is to sort of preserve the playfulness of what it is that we're doing. And I think if you have a spirit of playfulness, that's going to come across in the liveliness of the scene, whether it's a playful, funny scene or not. It's just like actually something is sort of alive there. And with all that, you know, blue screen, green screen, gray suits, whatever it is, you know, there's an element to which it is ridiculous, but there's also an element where all it's calling for is just more imagination. Like what mm-hmm. all we do, you know, whether I'm walking into a sort of photoreal set, it's still imagining that that's my house or your house or somebody's house. It's not, you know, but we're going to imagine it anyway. And the same thing when you're sort of walking out there and it's a big blue screen, you're like, right, Kong's going to be up there and he's going to be smashing into that over there, and you're just going to look there and then look there. It's like, right, you can sort of imagine that. I mean, when you see the ultimate movie, you're just like, wow, that is nothing like what I was seeing in my head. But we're called on to imagine, and sometimes we're called on to imagine in a very big way, a big scale. And I think, you know, that is play. That's, you know, I watch my kids playing like that, you know, all their whole lives. And it's just, I get to do that on a massive, massive scale. And you can't take that too seriously. I don't think, like, I don't want to see anyone take that too seriously. And I think that's a mistake that some of those movies make is trying to make it too serious. I mean, you know, don't get me wrong, there's a very heartfelt, soulful storyline through the middle of Godzilla and Kong, but it's also nice to have some humor thrown in there, because that is human, even in the face of extreme peril, even in very sort of dramatic, emotional times. Humor is there. Like, I've been to so many funerals where there's a surprising amount of humor, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's like, we don't have to take everything so seriously. And the idea that we should take that seriously. It seems a little off to me.
We've spoken a lot about, you know, the desire to try all these different kinds of roles and stuff, and what you want from, you know, being an actor and your career and all that stuff. Recently, your name popped up again because of the James Bond of it all. And, you know, there's just a lot of people saying, oh, yeah, I wish Dan Stevens was part of this conversation. I wish Dan Stevens was part of the conversation. Whether you're aware of that stuff or not, I'm always curious about how all the other stuff that goes into being an actor factors into, you know, how you approach the craft, how you approach your career. You know, those conversations of, oh, I can't believe Dan Stevens isn't up for James Bond. Are you aware of that stuff? Does that factor in, or is that something that you absolutely must keep to the side?
I mean, I'm not really aware of it, to be honest. I mean, yes, occasionally someone will ask you on a red carpet. I don't quite know why that role has become the benchmark of total success or something. You know, I love those movies. I've loved them over the years. Would I make a great one? Sure. But I think I'd rather be a villain. But, you know, that's not why I'm doing what I do. And I think you can see certain people who've made certain career choices that are leaning that way, and in they're kind of putting out the stall and being like, hey, what do you think about this? You know, and it's like, I look pretty good in a tuxedo, huh? You know, and actually, I don't know. I think it's a strange phenomenon that it's become the thing that must be achieved, because there's so much else out there that you can get your teeth into.
Absolutely. So as we, you know, sort of come to the end of our time here and in some attempt to wrap all this up in a bow, when you think back to, you know, that production of Macbeth and all those earlier intro to acting for you, in what ways now would you say that you're still the same actor?
I'm still figuring it all out. I think the thing that, you know, and I was having this conversation very recently with someone, it's like, having not trained, and I know this sounds silly, but having not gone to drama school, I still have kind of imposter syndrome with the industry a bit. And even Judi Dench, who I've worked with a few times, he always talks about the man with the bucket of ice cold water around the corner, which even for her, to have that still looming, that, you know, at some point somebody might just turn this off and say, you can't do this anymore. So I think I still have the same kind of insecurities of just like wanting to be invited to the party and get to play. And, you know, I don't think that's ever going to leave me.
I love that. And I think that keeps perspective. I think that's helpful.
It keeps me on my toes.
Absolutely. Dan, it was an absolute pleasure to talk to you. You know, we've got Godzilla and Kong, Cuckoo, Abigail, three very exciting things. Maybe you'll do some stand-up in the future. We'll see.
We'll see.
And look, they released that Guest 2 soundtrack a couple of years ago. I think a lot of us are still on board for a Guest sequel if it's ever in the books.
We'll see. You can enjoy the soundtrack in the meantime.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Dan, thank you so much.
Thanks very much.
Thanks, as always, to our brilliant producer, Jamie Muffet, and to the whole team at Backstage, Samantha Sherlock, Mark Stinson, Caitlin Watkins, and of course, Casey Howe. Visit Backstage.com, and don't forget, you can subscribe to Backstage with code ENVELOPE at checkout for a free trial. 100% free, you simply cannot beat that. For more exclusive content, find us on Facebook and Twitter at InTheEnvelope, and subscribe, share, and leave a comment. Who should we interview next? Let us know. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you next time for another peek in the envelope.